Watch your step. I've come to experience and honestly believe that much of the world's deeper truths only come to us as we grow older and live our lives and gain more experience. Point of fact is that for a long time I was very familiar with the story of Don Quixote, a man who envisioned himself a brave knight going about fighting dragons and saving his beloved princess Dulcinea, where Don Quixote saw a castle with turrets and magnificent gates. His ever faithful companion Pancho Sanchez only saw a dilapidated inn. In a poignant scene in the story, Quixote stands before this weathered inn, waxing eloquently about the magnificent structure that he sees. Pancho Sanchez, who is very confused by all this, carefully and with great detail shares with Don Quixote what he sees. And Quixote responds, "Stop! I will not allow your facts to interfere with my vision." Well, frankly, for a long time, I just didn't get the point of that story. That is, until some years ago, I was reading something that Tony Campola wrote about his experience of going to see the musical based on the story of Don Quixote entitled The Man of La Mancha. Campola was very much enjoying the musical when he was disturbed by the woman who was seated next to him, who was whispering emphatically to her husband, "Stop that. Stop that. You're embarrassing me." Well, Campola obviously wanted to know what was going on, so he leaned forward and he took a look at the husband. He was a properly dressed man with all the symbols of middle class wealth and status. The only thing unusual about him was that he was sobbing uncontrollably. Campola writes, "I knew why he was crying. It was because the man on the stage, the actor playing Don Quixote, was singing the theme song of that particular musical, To Dream the Impossible Dream. Many of you have heard that. He was singing about beating the unbeatable foe and striving with courage to go where the brave dare not go. He was singing to the audience that the world would be a richer place because one man, bruised and covered with scars, was still strove with all the courage he had to reach an unreachable star. The man was crying because he'd lost his dreams. Somewhere along the line, he had lost his vision in life." I get the point now. How many people today, maybe in this room, experience on a regular basis the following question: is this all there is? You can call it a midlife crisis, you can call it whatever you like, but the reality is many have lost their vision. Many folks struggle to find a reason for life itself, let alone even a reason to get up in the morning. Perhaps that's why so many people take an interest in the lives of celebrities and sports figures. They're acting as if their own lives are neither worthy of people's interests and neither are their daily pursuits of any value compared to celebrities. If the Christian life is nothing else, it is clearly an offer by God to dream the impossible dream. The Christian life is meant for us to live and see beyond the mundane nature of life and embrace something far grander than we could even imagine. Yet when we consider our experience as Christ followers, most of us would be hard-pressed to claim that it's been anything close to a grand adventure. Sadly, we would be apt to use words like mundane or boring to talk about our spiritual matters. I think I've figured out at least part of the reason we drift in this direction, you and I. Our Puritan roots as Protestants has for hundreds of years approached a passage like this one from 1 Peter and narrowly defined what being holy really is. Now, to be fair, Peter himself seems to take a certain track when it comes to living a holy life. He mentions self-control, doesn't he? He talks about avoiding slipping back into our old ways. Holiness, therefore, has come to mean for many people kind of a moral code or an ethical approach to life. And there's truth to that. There is truth to that. Living a holy life does include living a life that honors God. No argument. It means becoming more and more like Jesus. We can all agree on this, I'm sure. But in preparing for today, I did something I should have done many years ago. I actually went and researched the word holy. Frankly, I admit, as a kid growing up in the church, a person who has spent most of their life in church circles, holy is a word I thought I knew really well. Holy is a regular and integral part of word used in our religious vocabulary. I use it frequently. It crops up in many of our beloved hymns, and when people use it when they're speaking to me, or I'm listening to them, I'm pretty sure I know their intended meaning. I get it. However, in my research, I've discovered that I don't know this word very well at all. The word holy has a far richer history and depth of meaning than I could ever imagine. First of all, I state the perceived obvious meaning of the word. Holy means virtually the same thing, and in many cases, the same word as sanctify, which is closely related to the word sacred. It refers to something that is special, that is set apart, that is religious in nature. This is how we use the word when we're speaking about God, like saying that God is holy. Or how God uses this word when he speaks to Moses. Do you remember this moment? Take off your sandals. You are standing on holy ground, sacred ground. This meaning of the word is rarely meant to apply to people. Instead, the second meaning of the word holy is the one that is used most often in our conversation. That word means, of course, that we are to attain an ethical standard, a situation that we hope will honor God. The word holy comes from the Old English word hallig. The word hallig, in turn, likely is very closely related to an old Scottish word, hail, H-A-L-E. Now, this is a word you might be very familiar with. When you went to Scotland and you greeted somebody there some years back, you might hear the question, how are you? And the reply might have been in Scotland, I'm hale and hearty. It is this word hale that should grab our attention this morning, for this is the full meaning of the word holy. Hale means that a person is healthy, is whole, is uninjured, and is robust. It means a person is right as rain, has no complaints, and can take on the world. Or as my grandfather used to say, I'm able to sit up and take nourishment. Being holy means, therefore, that we are hale. We're healthy, we're whole, we're robust. Jesus expressed it actually in a more familiar way to us. He called it the abundant life. Yes, the holy life is about ethical and moral behaviors, but you know what? There's so much more. You remember Zacchaeus? I keep bringing him up because he's so important to me anyway. His encounter with Jesus was life-defining, life-turning. His new ethic, his new morality was not the only blessing that he got from meeting Jesus, nor was it even the most critical blessing. The joy and peace, the new birth that Zacchaeus felt was what really stole the show. You see, yes, Jesus can make you a better person, and many of us originally turned to him for just such a purpose. I get that. But Jesus seeks first and foremost to make us into whole people. Jesus seeks to make our lives robust. We need to recapture this grander vision of what a holy life is. This is especially true if we find ourselves facing the kind of persecution the early church did. I mean, the kind of church congregation which Peter is seeking to address. Think about it. Why would anyone endure severe persecution in following Jesus if all it meant was to bolster a list of thou shalt nots? The holy life comes not out of what we do or don't do. I realize that this line of thinking has major ramifications for social issues and how the church responds to them. A holy life comes from being, from that favorite evangelical phrase, born again. The Apostle Paul was very clear in his writing that we cannot earn this holy life by following the law. It's impossible because we'll fall short every time. The holy life, he says, is a gift from God. It originates out of his grace. Peter's concern today in this passage is what Eugene Peterson referred to as the sloppy life. I love that description because it captures Peter's concern in a way that I'm not going to forget anytime soon. The sloppy life is just as it suggests. It is a life that is chaotic, unfocused, undisciplined, neglected, lazy, frankly, a life that's a mess. And if we're not careful, a sloppy life can become so habitual that we think it's the only way of life and we get comfortable in it. The image that came to my mind immediately as an illustration of this is the homes and lives that are depicted on a show, I don't even know if it's still on anymore, called Hoarders. Have you seen this thing? It depicts people who accumulate so much stuff in their homes that their homes become frankly unlivable and dangerous. The people profiled in these shows have lots of stuff, but they're downright miserable. They cannot bring themselves to make the necessary changes to improve their lives. They're trapped in a situation of their own making. In the case of those who suffer from the hoarding disorder, intervention by family and mental health professionals is necessary. In terms of seeking a holy life, We need an intervention too, which God timely provided for us by giving his son Jesus to ransom us and deliver us from our unholy or sloppy lives. The issue remains, however, that we underestimate all the time the value of what he has given us. Some years ago at the Tucson Gem and Mineral Show, a gem dealer was just going around perusing what the other dealers of gems had or rocks that they had for sale at the show. And the man stopped at one particular booth because he happened to see this violet stone, the size and shape of a potato. He looked the stone over, checking the price tag, and casually asked the vendor, "You want $15 for this?" Well, the seller realized the rock wasn't as pretty as others in his bin, so he lowered the price to $10. Guess what? The stone has since been certified as a 1,905-carat natural star sapphire. It's 800 carats larger than the largest known sapphire. It is now appraised at $2.28 million. He got it for $10. Clearly, it took someone who knew and loved precious gems to recognize the value of what the seller had. It took the lover of our souls to look into each one of us and recognize the value of what lay within us and the willingness to pay the price to redeem us. As we examined in last week's passage, Christ Jesus seeks to purify our faith, to refine our lives. But having been refined, we do not want to clutter it back up by being sloppy. One of the regular contributors to the Toronto Star that I do like to read quite often is just a little tiny column called The Fixer. And the idea behind the column is that Toronto residents can call into the newspapers with some hazardous or unsightly or malfunctioning aspect of the city's infrastructure. So people email or they call in the locations of bad roads or faulty lighting or tripping hazards and also badly neglected pieces of public artwork from time to time. In almost every case, when the story is followed up, the problem exists because of a lack of maintenance or lack of follow-up. Somehow, the deficiency has occurred because someone was not on someone's to-do list that day. Sometimes, problems persist because, well, no one really knows whose responsibility it is. Is it the city? Is it Bell Canada? Is it Rogers Cable? Is it a private company? Is it an individual? And frankly, this stuff happens all the time because people get sloppy in their attention to detail. In our lives, we gotta be vigilant. We need to be aware of the Holy Spirit nudging us that something in our lives needs immediate attention. We need to be aware of the rust and the weeds and the potholes that are forming in our own lives and in our collective life together. The signs of a problem are clearly evident. Peter tells us that a lack of sincere love for each other is a sure sign that we're not as holy as we should be. Please notice that he said sincere love. The adjective is very important here. It indicates a love that is honest, that is truly heartfelt, not something that's contrived or faked because we think it's the Christian thing to do. I get a kick out of a collection of little cartoons, church cartoons that I have in one of my books. There's one about a church board meeting. It has not happened here, I guarantee you. It depicts the secretary of the committee reading the minutes of the previous board meeting. She reads in part. And so the meeting was adjourned and closed with prayer. Then the members retired to the parking lot to say what they really felt. Are you receiving sincere love? Better yet, are you dispensing sincere love? If not, then perhaps this is the cause of our life not being as abundant as we long for. Our faith and hearts are not as refined as they could be. Stuart Briscoe wrote a wonderful little book called The Integrity Crisis. The word integrity actually means wholeness. A person of integrity is someone who is the same in private as they are in public. A person of integrity does not say one thing and really believe another. Hypocrisy is not in the life of a truly whole person. A person living an abundant life, a holy life, is a person of integrity. A person of wholeness. God is holy and therefore God is perfect in his integrity. James wrote of God this way, every generous gift of giving with every perfect gift is from above, coming down from the Father of lights with whom there is no variation or shadow due to change. God never flip-flops, nor is God sloppy because God is holy. Therefore, because we are God's children, we should be holy too. It's time to cease the sloppiness that exists in our lives and to embrace the abundant life that Christ offers to us. An abundant life, by the way, that was purchased at tremendous cost.